April 8th meeting of the Watershed, Wetland, and Buffers Subcommittee is called to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Hanson?
Here.
Anzo?
Here.
Doty?
Here.
Gunther?
Here.
Hoppy? Peterson? Tingleton?
We do have a quorum. A quorum is present. So we can do business. Would you like to move the minutes from March 11th? Gunther moves. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is approved. Minutes are approved. This afternoon, and I know that some other committee is going on, and we're past the deadline, but we did want to talk about the Board of Water and Soil Resources Feedlot Financial Needs Report. This is a report that was mandated by the legislature last year. It came out recently, and I know there's a great deal of interest in this, and there'll be some public testimony as well. So I'd like to invite John Jaschke and Al Kane to come forward to discuss the report.
I'm just going to really let Al Kane provide the overview of the report, which we completed February of this year. And I know there are a number of other folks who'd like to testify, so I'll really just be short and I'll start going through the report. He's got a presentation, I believe it should be in the packet. Thank you.
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Al Kane, I'm the Chief Engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And in your packet, you should find four items related to the feedlot financial needs report. There is the report itself with a couple of pictures of the feedlot on the front, before and after. There is a summary presentation, PowerPoint in hard copy. And there is a two slides from the Department of Agriculture regarding the Ag B&T loan program. And the final sheet that I included, because I failed to put the location of the report on the Bowser website on the in the presentation document, I just made a separate sheet with that link on it. So what I will start with is the presentation dated April 1, when we had to postpone. So it is the same as what was prepared for that. And Representative Hanson indicated that, in fact, it was a directive to the Board of Water and Soil Resources from the legislature to look at the financial needs to bring all feedlots in the state that are under 300 animal units into compliance with the Pollution Control Agency rules by October 1, 2010, and to comply with another reference there in statute, Section 116.07, Subdivision 7, Paragraph 2. And we'll go over that, what that involves. Second page, slide 3. So the applicable rules are what we refer to as the feedlot rules, and Chapter 70.20. And there's four parts to the feedlot rule. The registration program, which requires feedlots that have greater than 10 animal units, 10 animal units or greater, in shoreland, and 50 or more animal units outside of shoreland to register. And that's been a requirement since these rules went into place in October of 2000. And the first deadline for that, I believe, was January of 2002. Another portion of the rules is the permit program. There are four types of permits: a construction short form permit, an interim permit. The interim permit is for feedlots that have been identified as having a pollution problem, and gives them a permit during the fix-up period. The NPDES permit, non-point pollution discharge elimination system, a federal permit administered by MPCA in Minnesota, and the SDS, or State Disposal System permit, which is a Minnesota permit also used for large feedlots. Another portion of the rules is the delegated county program. It's been around for quite some time in Minnesota, where counties do have the ability to issue certain permits, which does include permits for feedlots under 300 animal units. There are 54 counties in the state who participate in that delegated program. And the final part of the rules is the technical standard. And the standards address the discharge, water quality standards, the two wells in, referenced in there, 7050, design, construction, operation, closure, manure storage, and land application of manure. There are standards for all of those aspects of being in compliance with the CDOT rule. Slide four, the reference statute in the directive to Bowser is Pollution Control Agency powers and duties, and under the counties, the processing of applications for animal lot permits, paragraph P on slide 5, page 3, indicates that unless a feedlot is an immediate public health threat or a concentrated animal feedlot operation, which is defined by federal rule, MPCA cannot require a feedlot owner to spend more than $3,000 to upgrade a feedlot with less than 300 animal units, or $10,000 to upgrade a feedlot with 300 to 500 animal units, unless 75% cost share is available up to $50,000. And that $50,000 cap and the 75% rate are in fact the limits, if you will, within the state feedlot cost share program. Slide six, be aware that there has been two previous feedlot financial needs assessment reports. One was dated February 1, 2001. This one was directed by the legislature for the Department of Agriculture to pull together a needs assessment for all feedlot sizes subject to the feedlot rule. And in 2004, it was published as a revised report by the Department of Agriculture. That was a voluntary effort on the part of the Department of Ag to update the 2001 report. Dwight Wilcox, who is the Ag BNP Loan Program Manager, was the lead for those two reports. He worked with me substantially on developing the report that he provided to the legislature. And recognize, too, that all of the reports of these past two and the current one were done in cooperation with other federal, state, and local government units involved in feedlot pollution abatement. There are a number of entities involved. On page 4, slide 7, it's just a brief summary of the sources of information that we've used for these reports, including the current one. There are feedlot registration data, which is collected now via the e-link electronic reporting system that Bowser administered. Minnesota Ag Statistics annual report. Department of Agriculture works with federal folks in that regard, too, to produce those reports. We do have dairy inspectors in Minnesota that also do a dairy farm count annually. And the Ag BNP loan program administered by Department of Ag. Feedlot water quality management cost share program administered by Bowser. And the environmental quality incentives program, EQIP, is administered by the Natural Resources Conservation Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Also, the Clean Water Partnership grant and loan programs administered by Pollution Control Agency, and the EPA 319 program, which is Section 319 federal money, some of which also is used for feedlot pollution abatement competitive program. If we take a look at slide 8, trying to define just how many feedlots are required to register. And we use the 2007 Minnesota Ag Statistics data to define the number of livestock and total number of feedlots in the state. And we use the registration data to help distribute those by species and by feedlot size. So we use a combination of those two data sources to try to paint the most accurate picture we could about the number of feedlots that do need to register according to the rule. And that number is, in fact, 24,600 is our computed number. And of that 24,600, 21,600 have less than 300 animal units, which is about 88% of the total number of feedlots in Minnesota. We also were able to identify 11,800 feedlot enterprises that are smaller than the threshold to have to register. so less than 10 animal units in shoreland, less than 50 animal units outside of shoreland. Slide number 9 on page 5 shows the locations of feedlots within Minnesota. This is for all sizes. The map for less than 300 animal units looks very similar. Recall that about 90% of the feedlots in Minnesota are less than 300 animal units, so it looks quite similar. As you can see, the transition zone between the heavily row crop agriculture land and the forested region of Minnesota is a particularly dense area, if you will, for feedlots. And certainly down in southwestern Minnesota, there's also a significant number of feedlots in Minnesota. One of the things that we also then were trying to look at is the change in numbers of feedlots over time. There has been a lot of feedlot closure, if you will, lots of feedlots in the state over the years. The 1980 data that I referenced there was an estimate by the Pollution Control Agency, I believe, back to 1980, that identified approximately 90,000 feedlots in Minnesota of all sizes. And the current estimated total, including all sizes, is about 36,000. So there has been substantial consolidation, loss of feedlots over time in the state. And we used them, the 2002 to 2006 Ag Statistics data, to try to take a look at defining some annual rates of decline for different sizes and species of animal feedlots. And as you can see there, that there is a decreasing number of feedlots for all species in size categories with less than 500 animal units. However, during the 2002 to 2006 time period, there were increasing numbers of feedlots for hogs, dairy, and cattle with greater than 500 animal units. So there's been some consolidation and growth of the larger feedlots and decreases in the smaller number of feedlots. On page 6, slide 11, we then applied those computed decline rates to the number of feedlots that we had identified that needed to register, or that were registered on January 1 of 2007, to determine the approximate number that would be remaining, if you will, on October 1, 2010. So that calculation came up with then an estimated 18,000 feedlots with less than 300 animal units that would be required to register on October 1, 2010, or be registered on October 1, 2010, which is again about 86% of the total required to register as of that date. The next step that we pursued then was defining how many of those feedlots required to register and therefore comply with the rule do in fact need an environmental upgrade. And over the years, we've used several different ways of trying to get at that number. Back to the 2001 report, we did a relatively informal survey of SWCB and county staff involved in feedlot pollution abatement, and an overall estimate of 40% of the feedlots that existed at that point in time were estimated to need environmental upgrades. In 2004, the Department of Ag had started asking questions on their annual survey of local government units that participate in the Ag D&T loan program, which does in fact cover most of the state, and you'll see that in a subsequent slide of where all those Ag D&T loan projects are located. So the annual survey, then a question was asked about how many of the feedlots in their jurisdiction were estimated to need an environmental upgrade. In 2004, that number was 34%. By 2008, that number was 27%. So there has been a decline in the estimated numbers, or the percentage, if you will, of feedlots requiring environmental upgrades over the years, which is the direction we'd all like to see it move. Flipping to page 7, slide 13. This then is the numbers that we estimated for the different species that do need environmental upgrades by October 1, 2010. And note that the total for all sizes of feedlots is about 5,800, and 5,050 is the total number estimated for feedlots under 300 animal units. I also have a couple of percentages in there to take note of. Clearly the two largest species that need environmental upgrades are dairy and cattle operations. And the number for dairy there is 22% of the total needing an upgrade, and for cattle is 63%. There is in the report a table that also provides a bit more detail and history about that as well. If we take a look then at a summary again of the changing numbers of feedlots needing an upgrade on slide 14. In the 2001 report, we estimated 7,100 operations in that was total for all sizes, 6,000 for under 300 animal units. 2004, we estimated 7,800. Note that the number rose between 01 and 04, and the reason for that, we believe, is primarily because we started looking at them a little bit differently, separating out the feedlots where there are more than one enterprise. And the definition we're using for enterprise is that it's a separable feedlot, oftentimes of a different species. So that if a producer is raising multiple species, he may in fact have multiple enterprises that would need to be fixed differently because they're different species. And so we thought we ought to be counting those separately. And we did the same thing then in 2008 as we utilized that definition of an enterprise. And I believe the number that we came up with for the 2008 report was around 4,500 feedlots that we estimate have more than one enterprise involved with them. So there are a significant number. But do note again that the numbers of feedlots that we're estimating that need an upgrade between 04 and 08 has in fact declined. And it stays in that 80-some percent range for under 300 animal units of the total numbers out there. Page 8, slide 15, we then utilize some typical costs from several different programs to help put a cost number on the types of feedlots, environmental upgrades that are needed. So we use the Ag P&P Loan Program, which does have data on costs to upgrade feedlots and to purchase manure handling and application equipment. We utilize the Feedlot Water Quality Management Cost Share Program that Bowser administers, and use recent years' definitions of typical costs by size and species. And we also use similar data for the Environmental Quality Incentive Program from NRCS. So utilizing those by size and species, this table sums them all together. And we broke it out by several different categories. Feedlot runoff and manure storage, those are the more structural type of practices that these programs assist producers to install. And the direct engineering assistance, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the Feedlot Water Quality Environmental or Feedlot Water Quality Management Program, both provide a portion of the funding those programs can use for direct technical assistance. There's also, the state has the Non-Point Engineering Assistance Program administered by Bowser that provides funding for engineering staff to provide technical assistance for a wide range of conservation practices, including feedlot water quality management practices. So there we've estimated then funding for both of those components. Also, we identified manure management planning. That's an element, again, of technical assistance that is a significant need in a total package of environmental upgrades for feedlot projects. Another item, another category, is the manure handling and application equipment. That's one that the Ag BNC loan program provides loans for. The other three categories above it, there is grant money and loan money that can be used for those. And in the report, that's detailed much more than it is in this slide. Note then that for under 300 animal units, we came up with a total of $418 million need for all four of those categories. Again, that includes both grants and loans for those categories. We also did compute the numbers for the greater than 300 animal units so that this report did have numbers for all three lot sizes.
And those numbers are aggregate total numbers, not annual, correct?
Correct, Mr. Chairman. The next slide, just try to give you some idea of the types of practices that we assist producers in installing. I don't have good pictures for every type of practice, but we have some that I think will give you a good sense of the types of practices that are done. Slide 16 is a line feedlot runoff and their storage basin. The type of lining can vary depending upon the soil conditions of where these structures are put in place. Earthen liner or compacted clay liner is one type. There is plastic liners, there's geo composite liners. So several different ways that these are done, which is largely dependent upon the type of soil conditions where they're installed. Slide 17 is another slide. This is one in Stearns County that's actually close to a small lake. So note that in fact they can be constructed relatively close to riparian sources. And if that's the case, then certainly the type of design is such to protect those riparian waters. Slide 18 is a concrete manure storage tank. We also do cross here on metal storage tanks that are oftentimes glass lined to protect them against corrosion, and Flurry Store is one of the brands of those that is oftentimes used. Slide 19 on page 10 is an example of a vegetated filter strip. For small feedlots, oftentimes the runoff off of a feedlot can be adequately treated with a vegetated filter strip, where the vegetation uses up the nutrients and the vegetation is then periodically harvested to take those nutrients off of the filter strip and reuse them. Note in the foreground of that picture a gravel level spreader. The intent of that feature is to provide good sheet flow across that filter strip. So that's one of the ways that that's done, is through a gravel level spreader. Slide 20 is an example of a cattle crossing. And in this case, you can't see it very well, but there is, in the lower right, there's an electric fence. And so oftentimes, when these types of practices are put in place, the cattle will be directed just to that cattle crossing so that they all cross there. They don't spend their time standing in the stream or creek. And another picture on slide 21, page 11, of the livestock exclusion. Oftentimes, too, livestock exclusion is used in conjunction with rotational grazing, so that there'll be fencing done that enables the producer then to better utilize vegetation, but also better manage it to prevent erosion and pollution. Slide 22 is a compilation of all of the funding sources that are used for both grants, loans, and technical assistance. And what I tried to do here was to get some sense of the total amount that has been used for this purpose since the current CDOT rule was put in place in October of 2000. So to give you a sense of how much has been invested from various sources, including landowners, and then an average, if you will, over time, and obviously that has fluctuated somewhat, but the average over that period is about 13 million. Page 12, slide 23. This is a compilation of current feedlot and technical assistance, financial and technical assistance for feedlots. Again, it's the same programs that have been mentioned before, and this one identifies them, the types of financial and technical assistance provided, grants and loans, or just direct technical assistance. Note that that total investment out of all those programs is currently about $16 million a year. But I must point out to you also that this is for all feedlot sizes. And in recent years, the Environmental Quality Incentive Program has removed any size limits on feedlots that are eligible. And so there's been more funding from EQIP that has gone to larger feedlots than in past years. And right now, I believe it's approximately 50% of their structural and feedlot runoff type practices and money that goes to feedlots with less than 300 animal units. And in the report, you'll find more detail also in that regard. What I tried to do then, and summarized in slide 24, is to take a look at utilizing the information that we have, both about decline rates and the typical cost to upgrade feedlots to comply with the rule. I took a look first at the current numbers of feedlots that are being done. So for dairy, which has in the recent years a decline rate of about 7% per year, and again recognize that that does fluctuate somewhat, but I just used the current number and projected into the future for lack of knowing how else to predict how that might occur. But then trying to get a sense of how long might it be before we would be fully compliant for all dairy feedlots under 300 animal units. At the current rate of fixes, which is about 40 per year, and the estimated years then until all comply is about 15, and the fourth column there identifies the estimated financial and technical assistance needs at 75% cost share. So this is 75% of the total that we had estimated for that number of dairy feedlots over the 15 years. And then the bottom row was trying to take a look at, well, how many would we have to do per year to have them all comply within 10 years? So trying to give all of you and others a sense just of how hard do we have to work at it if we've got a certain goal in terms of time in mind. And so that number would be then 70 feedlots per year over 10 years is estimated to bring all of the dairy feedlots under 300 animals into compliance within that 10 years. And again, at 75% cost share, the estimated cost is $7 million per year. Went through a similar exercise for cattle feedlots. Recall that about 63% of the estimated feedlots needing environmental upgrades at this point in time are cattle feedlots, so there's many more of them around the state than there are dairies. And And so at the current rate of 25 cattle feedlots per year being brought up to compliance, it would take 50 years to bring them all into compliance. And then I did another estimate there for 10 years to say, well, how many would we have to bring into compliance per year if, in fact, the goal was to have them all in compliance within 10 years. I note as I look at this chart, too, that I have a typo there. In the third column, the header, it says dairy. That should be cattle feedlots. I had copied over it. And again, we tried to estimate then the amount of funding at 75% cost share that would be required per year to accomplish those two different scenarios. And note that the annual rate of closure is about 3%, and I see that I also have a typo there. It says dairy, and that should be cattle feedlot. So trying to give a sense of our current pace and the pace that it would be required if 10 years was the scenario that was a goal. Slide 26, and identified several of the key elements that I think we all should be aware of as we think about compliance with the rule. Environmental upgrades typically do have a limited direct financial benefit to the livestock producer. Some of the environment or the financial benefits to a producer may in fact relate to better manure management, which therefore reduces fertilizer costs. And these days that is very significant as the cost of fertilizer has gone up dramatically. But within the feedlot itself, typically there's not a great or economic improvement, if you will, to the operation. There can be some, but the reality is that many producers are reluctant to take these on their own because they typically can cost a significant amount, and therefore they do look to grants, loans, and other technical assistance to assist them. We do, in fact, very frequently piggyback state and federal financial and technical assistance to assist livestock producers to upgrade their feedlots. And therefore, we have, over the years, piggybacked many for water quality restoration and protection in Minnesota, and we continue to do so. And we do try to do all that we can to help coordinate the timing of the applications too, to help make that happen. Technical assistance is a very critical need for feedlot projects. Many of these are not simple in terms of the type of design that are needed to fit with the existing feedlot constraints, both in terms of location and topography and soil. So technical assistance is something that livestock producers do look to these programs to help provide to do it right. Another reality in recent years is that the federal funding for technical assistance has become much more constrained, and therefore the state program is in fact looked to significantly also to provide technical assistance for feedlot environmental upgrades. And with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I will stand for questions.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at kind of the overall picture here and seeing what we all know, that the average number of animals is increasing in any operation statewide. And looking at the numbers that say 88% are under 300 animal units, which means 12% roughly would be over that. And then further on we see the cost, a little over a fourth of all the costs seems to go to the large ones. So putting all that together, and then we get to slides 24 and 25 showing the projections if we kick up the speed to a 10-year target. I see you have the annual rate of closure figured in both of those. Are you also estimating then the continued increase in herd size?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first I have to again make sure that we're aware that in some of these stripes I have all feedlot sizes and some I have just under 300 animal units. So the slides at the end there, looking at the scenarios into the future, are for just under 300 animal units. Mm-hmm. We know that in recent years, particularly as the Environmental Quality Incentive Program has opened to larger feedlots, there is in fact a significant amount of money that's going there. Some of those projects have involved some innovative manure digesters and that type of facility too that's quite expensive. So it does bias the numbers significantly for all feedlots as compared to the number 300 animal units. We have not tried to look at, for the under 300 animal units, how much will they increase in size, grow their herd, if you will, during that period. Your point's well taken. The state cost share program only cost shares on fixing the existing size. If a producer wants to enlarge, they can certainly do that as part of the upgrade of their facility for environmental reasons, but the state would not cost share on the enlargement. The EQIP program of USDA and NRCS allows a 25% increase, I believe, in enlargement, but it's also cost share. So there's a little bit of variation in the program rules, but generally for state cost share will help fix the existing situation. Landowner wants to enlarge, they need to pay for that on their own.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm just trying to get a handle on what the real total number would be over 10 years. It's hard to put all that together. So, thank you.
Mr. Keenan, looking at slide 5, slide 13, slide 15. So, trying to put this together, we have 2.5 years. We upgrade 5,000 feedlots that kick in the requirement on slide 5, which would require $418 million. Is that right? That sounds right.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Again, keep in mind that the $418 million is both grants and loans, so that some of the funding that would be required there could, in fact, in terms of the loans and the revolving loan program of the AGNP loan programs, some may actually already be in the capital account of that. Not all would need to be new money for loans.
And on average, we've spent $13 million. I'm using we here, aggregate federal and state grant and loan. We spent about $13 million a year, and this year we're spending $16 million. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So it will be impossible to complete this requirement in 2.5 years. Representative Anzel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just dovetailing off the chair's line of questioning here, and I should start by reminding everybody, if you look at the map, you'll see northeastern Minnesota doesn't have a lot of red dots. However, that doesn't mean that we don't care. What I'm hearing is declining federal financial participation. I hope stable state support, perhaps even decline. Huge need, huge public interest. And my question is, could you talk a little bit about voluntary compliance and do producers, I mean, does that get factored into all of this at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, first I need to be careful that, in fact, the federal investment in livestock environmental upgrades since the current rules were put in place has increased.
Oh.
It's actually increased significantly. Now, along with that came some changes in the limit, which therefore enables quite a bit more money to go to larger facilities. So that's one reality. The state feedlot cost share funding peaked in, I think, about 2002. The state budget shortfall in 2002-2003 did result in some cuts in feedlot water quality cost share. It's been stable at $1.5 million per year since then. The source was changed last year to be within the Clean Water Legacy funding, but also at $1.5 million per year. We know that there's been substantial consolidation. The total numbers of livestock in the state hasn't varied nearly as much as the number of feedlots. And I don't have those numbers at my hand. I was talking to an MPCA staff person recently about that and the fact that we should update that chart to take a look, too, at the number of feedlots in the state over time versus the number of livestock. And I think you'll find, not surprisingly, there's been lots of consolidation and the total number of livestock has not dropped like the total number of feedlots.
Just a follow-up. Is voluntary compliance a factor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I apologize for not answering that piece of your first question.
That's okay.
Certainly, the Soil Water Conservation District, County Feedlot Officers, Natural Resources Conservation Service, we're all trying to work with producers in a voluntary mode because that's the way we do business, if you will, for conservation practices and therefore encourage participation. And certainly there's a focus on what the producers are targeted to go talk to based upon their level of a problem, if you will. So therefore their potential impact on water quality is certainly one of the factors that is utilized by all of those frontline staff in identifying who to target the conversations at the kitchen table with first, second, and third.
Okay. Thank you. Mrs. Lamborghini.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good information. I appreciate your bringing it to us. But I can't see from here how to get to the budget next year. I'm thinking ahead without diminishing our environmental standards. Are you working on a plan to get the job done? How we get, how we rework things, and all without diminishing environmental standards? Is that what you're going to be proposing? And then let me just add one more element here. We know we're going to come into a deficit next year. That's clear. While our budget, supplemental budget, reduces the amount of deficit for next year if it passes, if there's still a deficit.
Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think all of us involved in feedlot environmental compliance are quite aware that the need is great, the funding is limited. Because of the directive for us to do this report, we have initiated discussions with other agencies, the Pollution Control Agency, Department of Ag, and NRCS, to talk about what is the current status, where we are, and what are some strategies for moving forward, recognizing that the feedlot rules do have a deadline in them, and we know that that's going to be a topic that the legislature will be wrestling with next session, so we're intending to do some homework to help bring forth some ideas about how that might best be addressed.
One of the things that we need are a lot of facts. So this is kind of the basic of the fact.
So that's good.
But there also has to be a will to upgrade and change. And I'm hoping you all find that will, too. That's going to be hard, but it's absolutely necessary. Because we know we're coming into a deficit. Do you think you can get the job done?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Virginius, I should point out, too, that historically, for the state DLUC water quality management cost share, we've had applications that are 2 to 3 times the amount of funding available. So there has been, in fact, a demand, or a will, if you will, on the part of livestock producers to come forth to upgrade. I can't speak for the EQIP program in terms of the ratio of demand to supply, but I would expect that, in fact, there's been more demand than supply also in that regard. So there is a willingness out there. We're all trying, I think, through the Clean Water Legacy program now, too, where the funding came this current biennium to focus on impaired waters as a priority. That sometimes may conflict with readiness on the part of a landowner or producer, because some of our conservation districts often point out to us at Bowser that they need to be ready to work with the producer when the producer is ready, because it sometimes will take some information and encouragement to look at how it might be done in an economical fashion to the producer.
Representative Virginia.
Are you hearing, I mean, one of the reasons that obviously we're targeted to clean water is because that's a priority without a funding stream. Are folks discussing what would happen if there was a constitutional amendment adopted and that clean water had a stream of funding that it didn't have before? Are folks interested in the constitutional amendment passing? Have they connected two and two here or not?
Mr. Kane and
Mr. Chairman, Representative Virginius, as a matter of fact, just this morning within Bowser, we had a senior management team meeting, and that's one of the questions we posed to ourselves. What if it passes or it doesn't pass? What's our plan? And I think we certainly intend to try to look at those scenarios in a way that help us be ready no matter what the outcome is.
Well, I'm going beyond the what if. I'm asking a more basic question. Is there discussion in the community? Is there any understanding in the larger community that might be helpful in the future, given this budget constraint? The fact that we're not interested in reducing standards, that one of the helpful things would be the constitutional amendment. Are people getting it that might be helpful, or do you hear any discussions that way?
Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'm afraid I'm going to have to plead relative ignorance.
Okay.
But then, I don't know that I can tell you that what is and isn't being discussed out there on the front lines in that regard.
Well, that actually is telling us a lot that perhaps it's not being discussed and those connections aren't being made. So I think you're actually going to answer my question very nicely. Thank you.
Looks like Ms. Erickson is ready to answer that question. Since she's already at the table, I think I'll... Ms.
Erickson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Sue Erickson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of a lot of conservation districts, and I did want to assure you that our members are discussing this very, very much, the dedicated funding, and in fact passed a resolution of support for the ballot question, and we'll be looking at the Yes to Minnesota campaign to see how we can engage in that issue. And so our members are very, very much aware, and they're very tied into the Clean Water Legacy funding. It's an important program for them, as well as the Habitat. So yeah, they're talking about it and they're excited.
Ms. Erickson, I know we as members get a ton of emails from folks focused on the game and fish portion, but we just don't receive any emails or anything on the clean water and the $91 million that would go there. So I would hope that, and I see a number of folks in the room that could maybe look to support it when it comes on the ballot this fall. And I appreciate that the SWCDs have done it, but they really can't lobby as governmental officials. They can, you know, do resolutions and that, but actually campaigning, their government. So it'll fall upon the farm groups and that to realize that there's a seat at the table there for the money when this comes in. Mr. Kane, I have a question. Were you here for you?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to go back to slide number 5, and that's the actual statutory requirement. What year was that passed? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, I will venture a guess because I think it's in the ballpark. I believe it was shortly after the new feedlot rule was put in place. I will guess it's 2000-2001. I don't know that for a fact.
Mr. Kane, so it looks like there's some definitions here that I would ask if Bowser has not done them or looked at these already, to look at the question of $3,000, which we've had inflation over 10 years, under 300 animal units, $10,000 for the 300 to 500, and the 75% cost share. I mean, what would the runs be if it was 50% cost share, 25% cost share, available up to $50,000 or $25,000? Looking at this particular definition, it's tied in with the money, that it obligates the money. And I don't know if you have those numbers, but I think those are the type of things that we would probably be looking at next year, and how do we deal with this?
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chairman, well taken. We do not have those numbers at hand today, but we'll certainly take them under advisement.
Mr. Counselor, do you have anything?
Well, basically, it looks to me like there's a trend towards bigness and away from smallness. And it reminds me of what I believe was the first county that did a feedlot inspection report, and that was Lewis County. And they pointed out that approximately 490 some feedlots in Lewis County, as I recall, took quite a while, that the vast majority of those were flooding with cattle on hills and feedlots 50 years older and with less than 65 animal units. Is that still the trend today? And are we seeing those feedlots get closer to this 2010 date, just fall off and not be there anymore?
Mr. Kane.
Chairman, Representative. I think, again, the numbers show that, in fact, it still is small feedlots that are the largest number and therefore clearly the largest problem. But recognize too that over the years, feedlots typically were located in riparian locations for water source. So we have an inherent issue there. We do, within the state cost share program, and I believe also within EQIP, there is the ability to relocate a feedlot. We try not to do that unless it's really necessary because it might be quite expensive. And a producer typically will have to bear a lot of that cost because we don't cost share on building new buildings at this new site. But I've seen several over the years where, in fact, a former feedlot that's been closed that was not riparian was relocated to by a feedlot that was riparian. So that's one of the ways that we're trying to deal with that issue. One of the things that we should also keep in mind is that, and I was at a Southeast Minnesota Flood Response Forum last Friday, and some of the soil water conservation district staff who I spoke with reminded me of the importance of small feedlots in that topography as also helping to provide for rotations of crops, hay, small grains, that really is quite beneficial to erosion control. So while to a certain extent the feedlots all get big, it'll be easier for them to economically address environmental quality compliance
there are also are a lot of good reasons for us to try to promote small feedlots.
I can certainly see it in the southeastern part of the state because the geography lends itself to smaller feedlots. Where I live in the south central part of the state, it probably lends itself to bigger feedlots, and that's what we're having. Specific species are also a big player in the state. So it's amazing how diverse the state is and how hard it's going to be for some areas to comply with the 2010 date.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. King,
can I add? Do be aware, too, we talked about southeast Minnesota, but really the whole transition zone between the flatter row crop agriculture land and the forested land, the topography is such that the small feedlots are beneficial in many ways, and they're located there for a reason, because they fit the landscape in terms of land use better as well.
Mr. King and members, before we get to the public testimony, I want to just note that I know that folks were concerned when last year in the budget we moved from the base budget to the Clean Water Legacy and prioritized to impaired waters. And part of that has been, I think, documented here now in the report that if we have this large need, we needed to prioritize, and so we did that. Also by doing that, the program Escape the Budget Cutting Act, that the part that remained, the buffer cost share, that remained within the base was cut significantly, and the one-time Clean Water Legacy money was not cut. And we had to cut into the tails deeper than in the existing budget. So the money that was there for Clean Water Legacy has stayed and is being used. So I would like to just ask a question about this year's appropriation and how much demand you have for feedlot water quality grants right now, and maybe that process just in this particular biennium.
Mr. Chairman, the application period for feedlot water quality grants went out the 1st of March, and they're due back the 1st of May. So I can't tell you the demand for FY09 funding. In FY08, I will do a little bit of guessing, but I think it's consistent with what our history has been, that it's been 2 to 3 times the demand for the state cost share funding that is available. And I would expect that to continue into the foreseeable future.
Any more questions for Mr. King? Thank you. Milk producers.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob LaFave. I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. We're the grassroots dairy farmer association in the state of Minnesota. First of all, I want to commend Representative Hansen and the committee and the legislature for asking for this report. Secondly, I commend Al and the chief author and Director John Gaffney and the staff and all the agencies for assembling the report. I think it was thorough and pretty easy to understand. The report, as you know, it shows that we have a huge issue facing us. Over $400 million in need for feedlot fix-ups if the state's going to follow through on the promise that it made to the citizens of Minnesota when they enacted the feedlot rules 8 years ago. Breaking it down further, specifically within dairy, we have 1,100 dairy operations out of a total of just slightly under 5,000 that are left in the state of Minnesota today that need assistance, and they need that assistance prior to 2010, according to the feedlot rules. Obviously, as a grassroots dairy farmer organization, we don't want to see a single farmer go out of business, due to the lack of cost share assistance needed to help them achieve compliance. But even aside from us as dairy producers, not wanting to see our colleagues leave in the industry, keeping well-managed dairy farms in the landscape is also beneficial to every other Minnesotan because of the improvements to our natural resources and to our economy. Again, well-managed dairy, regardless of size. Well-managed dairies actually help to improve our watershed. Manure from our cows, when properly applied, improves the soil profile and significantly reduces soil erosion. Alfalfa is required for our cow's diet. For a good, healthy diet, they need alfalfa. Alfalfa in the rotation also helps to reduce soil erosion and pollution discharge, if you will. These are just a couple of the examples on the natural resource side. Keeping dairy in the landscape is also good economic development for our rural towns and our urban neighbors. We rely on many local vendors for our equipment and our repairs, regardless of size. Dairy more than other livestock, not just, but we do rely heavily. We do need our local vendors. Our cows need to be cared for, fed, and milked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And many of our urban cousins have jobs that are directly or indirectly related to the food production chain. 20% of Minnesota's jobs are related to the food production chain. I guess this leads me back to the report. If the state had unlimited resources, you could just allocate the $400 million needed and we could all go home. But unfortunately, we don't live in that in most times, and the state doesn't have unlimited resources. So we need to come up with innovative solutions to address the challenge. And we at Minnesota Milk believe that one of the items that can help address the current challenge the state's facing is the Livestock Environmental Quality Assurance Program, or LEQA. This program is currently being funded in part by Clean Water Legacy Funding that came through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The LEQA program was developed with support of a consortium of numerous stakeholders, including Minnesota Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, Pheasants Forever, Minnesota Project, Minnesota Cattlemen, the Association of County Feedlot Officers, Minnesota Association of MASCWID, Minnesota SWCD, Minnesota Milk, many state agencies, including Bowser and PCA, DNR, and others, as I mentioned. The foundation for this LEQA program came from Minnesota Milk Environmental Quality Assurance Program that's been operating since 2002 with partial support from MPCA. The process basically, for certified third-party technician, performs an assessment of the livestock operation. From that assessment, they're developing an action plan, an environmental action plan with the farmer. Then they work it with the farmer, helping to connect public cost share assistance and resources, moving those farmers to a level that meets or exceeds state regulation. Voluntary compliance, I think, was the term that was used earlier. With relatively few resources, Minnesota Milk has helped nearly 400 dairy producers improve their environmental stewardship practices through the EQA program in the last 6 years. Relatively few resources, and again, I want to thank MPCA for their support of that. This new livestock EQA, the new generation, if you will, and I'll explain that. Basically, for several reasons. One, it expands to also include beef operations. We heard earlier we have 27% of the dairy producers, roughly a quarter of the dairy producers, need to have fix-ups done, if you will, prior to 2010 in order to come into compliance. That number is higher for beef. Well, now we're including beef into this program. It's also an effective tool for PNGL plans. We're doing, I think, a very good job of evaluating waters of the state. You know, we're being able to evaluate our impaired, if they're impaired or not. I think we're doing a good job on that. But we really currently have no effective means of evaluating the landscape of these watersheds. Well, the LEQA program has definite potential for evaluating the landscape. The results of practices on the farm and result then to our waters, to those impaired waters, by taking local practices. It also brings private and public resources together in a well-tested and proven system. I mentioned the diverse group of stakeholders. I don't think I need to go into that as far as all the players involved. It does have a benefit to the producers because we're taking a look at environmental improvements to the operation. That also takes into account the family's business plan. You heard Alphine before mention how these improvements being made on the farm many times have very, very limited economic impact to that farmer. And that's true. So that's why it's important to also take a look at that business plan that the farmer has to make sure that these environmental improvements also fit within that business plan to make him more producers willing, as Representative Wagenius had suggested earlier. And of course, it does benefit of the state. Removing producers, improving their practices, which improves the natural resources for everyone in Minnesota. At the same time, we do recognize that this LUCA program is not the only solution, but it certainly is a program that should be a part of the solution, along with other options. It brings private industry into the system, and it helps us achieve more results with fewer resources. We have experience at Minnesota Milk in creative and innovative solution-driven programs. We've demonstrated that through the UCLA program. In closing, I guess we understand that we're not going to solve all the challenges here today, but this report does give us the foundation for discussions over the next several months to find solutions. And we ask that we're part of these discussions as we all work towards improving our natural resources in a manner that respects those families making a living while working the land. And on behalf of Minnesota's dairy farmers, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
My background is a grocer, and I talked to perhaps a different group of people than a lot of people here do. Land O'Lakes, Skip Campbell said that what they need is 10 5,000 head dairy herds in order to assure that we keep the processes they have here in the area, which has got to be a concern to the dairy producers. They don't have a market in a reasonable distance to send their products. They're in pretty much trouble. I remember the Mountain Lake butter plant went to California, and I thought that was kind of almost a sin. What are we doing by maintaining the status quo as far as number of dairy cows? What are we doing to give some incentives for them to stay here by producing more milk? I know Wells Blue Bunny is bringing cream from Florida every week to make their ice cream, the largest ice cream manufacturing plant in the world, I believe. They can't get enough cream in the Midwest.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative. Very good point. Kip Campbell, with all due respect, with Dean Foods, which does the bottling within Minnesota, part of it, they're connected with Land O'Lakes, but it's in Dean Foods, and that does represent about 15% of the milk that's produced in Minnesota that goes to bottling. The other roughly 75%, I'll say, goes to cheese, and the rest goes into other products. Over the last 3 years, Minnesota has actually been up in milk production. We've got up a number of cows, and I think it's in large part due to the fact that dairy producers are more and more each day looking for options on what they can do to be part of the industry in the future. There's a lot of uncertainty. But we are seeing many, many more dairy producers, young people too, getting into it. So I think there's a lot of things happening. I could sit here and talk to you for hours about some of the interesting things that young people are doing to get into it, and our existing producers on the innovative things they're looking at so they can stay in the business. Many are adding a few cows, and a lot of it's due to social issues. They don't have as many neighbors around them that milk cows and anymore, so they don't want to get to the point where they have enough cows so they can get off the farm because milk them 24/7. So they are going to have some cows, make life better for the cows, make life better for the farmer. So that's why we're seeing a lot of more and more expansion. But I think we are doing a lot of things, and actually the aid committees in both the House and Senate have really been working hard on that, and they continue to find ways of providing incentives for producers to improve their livelihood.
So if they wanted to go back to the actual grant or the evaluation program that you're doing, are you suggesting then that program would be in addition or as maybe a substitute for the cost share requirement, or that it would be an alternative to rule compliance? I'm coming back to this $418 million and looking at ways to how do we deal with it. Is that what you're specifically suggesting, or are you just kind of putting that out there as some as an option for that?
Mr. Chair, at this point in time, we want to continue to have discussions. We're not going to be so bold as to say absolutely this is the way they should go. We certainly believe that it should be a component of it. And certainly now with this new generation and some of the other benefits that I think we're going to realize, it's a way of getting producers in, helping them assess where they're at. And once you assess where they're at on their own farm, then, and they have a plan, then they can go ahead and start searching for cost share assistance. That absolutely should be a part of it. I don't think that we'd want to make it a mandatory piece, because then, mandatory for farmers is a regulation, and they're a little bit. The reason I believe it works is because it's been a voluntary program. So we're certainly pulling more and more into it.
I would ask you to look at the same questions I asked Mr. Kane. 3,000, under 300, 10,000, 300 to 500, 75%, 50,000, and 2010. Look at those numbers and see. And I've committed to you in the past that if we have time, which I think we will, to come around and have some of these, at least have a hearing or more than one outside of this building so that we can hear directly. But we as I think everybody knows here, these are some huge numbers that are very difficult for us. And we are asking for really specific ways of dealing with this in a very short period of time before next year. So any concrete suggestions, if you want to write up some things or go through your normal resolution process, but we're looking for help here because this is an overwhelming mountain of music.
I can, Mr. Chairman, I certainly can appreciate that. I can say right now at this point in time it would be very difficult for Minnesota Milk and highly unlikely that we would, that our membership would support increasing those dollar amounts, in part because that makes it more difficult for our smaller dairy farmers to meet the requirements. It's going to cost them more when there's little to no economic gain for them to make these environmental improvements. They're making them for the betterment of the rest of Minnesota and operation. So that would be very difficult. And I guess if I may, Mr. Chair, Al Kane did, I think, do a great job testifying. I think one thing that he did miss was that all the state feedlot water quality grants, water quality management grants, are specifically earmarked for those under 300 animal units. I think Representative Doty did bring up, on the disparity there, and all those are specifically earmarked for those. So there is none of those grants are being used for anyone over 300 animal units.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Becky Schloss and Holt with the Minnesota Association of County Feedlot Officers. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Becky Schloss von Holt, and I represent the Minnesota Association of County Feedlot Officers and the Association of Minnesota County. I too commend the committee or subcommittee for didn't meet this report. We were requesting this report, and Bowser for doing an excellent job in compiling this valuable information. The Minnesota Association of County Seabed Officers is made up of 70 members from 56 delegated counties. It is an organization that which maintains a productive and symbiotic relationship with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and works closely with other agencies to educate the public and livestock producers and implement the feedlot rules. Many of our members also work closely with other organizations to serve these purposes. We have the infrastructure in place to work with the producers to comply with the rules and to get them into compliance with the issues that they have. Our members are either members or employees of the Soil and Water Conservation District or of the county. They have their feet on the ground, on the farm, working to assist the livestock producers with permitting, registration, and compliance matters. When possible, our members work with the producers to come up with easy fixes that they can do on their own and do not require the need to tap into the state tax system. In addition, there has been funding available through the, in the past, from the feedlot program from past years for open lot technicians. And that, those positions will be running out come September. Those staff members were also available to assist the producers with simple, easy fixes when available. Otherwise, they were referred to the Soil and Water Conservation District for testing. Our members also have the task of enforcement and dealing with food complaints. Our compliance issues typically are involving manure runoff from open lot areas, manure storage, typically capacity issues or unpermitted non-compliant structures, manure application, and dead animal disposal. The livestock producers that our members work with can range from the small hobby and horse farms to the mid-sized dairy farms to the large turkey facilities and large dairy facilities. One of the MAFCO, the Minnesota Association of County Seabed Officers, objectives include encouraging sound, consistent, effective, and productive legislation, regulations, and administrative procedures in the animal feedlot industry. And I'm sure as you are aware, I mentioned earlier that the livestock across the state varies greatly by species as well as what the status of compliance. As I think you were alluding to earlier, one of the representatives here was mentioning that some of the feedlots are total confinement and there are less issues associated with meeting the goals. However, across the state and talking with our members, the need is there, obviously, as demonstrated by the report. And the state cost of maps to federal funds, as was mentioned earlier. A county seabed officer's ability to enforce the seabed rule is directly associated with the cost of funding available, as outlined by Minnesota Statute 116.07. And that need is also tied for enforcement when needed to the economics of the livestock industry and its ability to remain a vital contributor to local economies and state economies. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture's website states the economic impact of livestock industry is generating $21 billion in total economic impact, creating economic activity in many other sectors, including agriculture, manufacturing, transportation, trade, services, and construction. In addition, as many of you are likely aware, feedlot compliance is important and closely related to initiatives involving the Clean Water Act, total maximum daily load, drinking water supply, and infant areas in some cases. And with the Clean Water Legacy Act and the requirement for prioritizing the funding to those impaired waters, that has created some issues in some of the districts where there are no impaired waters listed. And even though those waters may be impaired, the funding for those producers that are willing to do that time are not available. Our members are more than willing to organize a site visit and or a tour of feedlots that have received cost share funding or are in need of cost share funding, if that is of interest to any of the members. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing us to speak on behalf, or allowing me to speak today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Chief Officers and the Association of Minnesota County. And then I would be willing to take any questions.
Any questions? Thank you. Anyone else seeking to testify? PCA?
I can identify myself in case there are questions. I'm Wayne Anderson with Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we also just commend all our partners that in various agencies, as well as Minnesota Industry Partner and UA program. I think this was an important report to get out. This is a critical time heading toward 2010. If there are any questions relative to the rules of that, I'll answer them. Otherwise, we contribute to this report, but I think Boulder has done a good job of presenting.
Any questions? Thank you, Wayne. Mr. Kohler, you've been waiting patiently, and so I know you have the federal money, so at least we want to hear from the banker, I think. Quickly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Tim Kohler. I'm with the NRCS, USDA NRCS Natural Resources Conservation Service. I provided the testimony to you before. Just a couple of things, and again, the report that was done by Bowser and many partners is an excellent analysis of where we are today and where we've come from. We provided quite a bit of information for the report also. A couple of points that I just wanted to quickly make. In our program, where we have now gone to a 50% cost share basis on conservation practices with the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, that's EQIP for short, one important point to continue to make is that every dollar that we put in, a producer is putting a dollar in. So when we spend, for instance, in 2008, we're just kind of wrapping up our obligation, and we have almost $15 million that have been put towards livestock-related practices. That means another $15 million was put with the producers, too, or even more, because in some cases they put in more than what we require. So, significant investment by private producers. I think there were some questions before about how many voluntary type of things were being done, and I think by a producer putting dollar for dollar in is a heck of a voluntary commitment in addition to the 2010 challenge. Just a couple of other quick ones. The benefits, as we've talked about, almost every one of our projects, when they're implemented, are involving just all sorts of different job-related type of benefits that deal with individual contractors and seed dealers and manure haulers and construction people. So, I mean, the impact, the economic impact multiplier is really huge with the effort. I do want to mention two other quick things, and then I'll stop it in case there's any questions. We did take an initiative this year, and as Bob mentioned, with Minnesota Milk, and increased cost sharing up to 90% for beginning farmers this year. We spent almost $4 million statewide, and a number of those, almost a couple million of that, was spent on new livestock-related enterprises. Understanding that usually someone who is just starting in an industry like this does not have a lot of resources. And so one of the first things they may cut out when they're trying to pay the bill is conservation. So that was an initiative that we did with recommendations from all the producer groups and many others. And then the last thing, which I think all of you are very well aware of, we still are treading water, not having a new farm bill. The Environmental Quality Incentives Program is in every version of the Farm Bill that I've seen so far, House, Senate, President, compromise versions, etc. Very popular program. We're sure hoping that it continues to be funded at or above the roughly $1 billion a year that it's funded nationwide. So with that, I'll stop.
Any questions for Mr. Kohler? Mr. Kohler, just since yesterday the governor did sign the bonding bill, and you referenced the temporary extension of the farm bill, and I think in the bonding bill we have two reports just on progress with capturing WRP. Could you maybe just for the committee give a short update of where we're at with that, since I have you there?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, as Representative Hansen is referencing, at one point, a few months ago, there was $40, $45 million in Washington that was going to expire at the end of, or middle of March. That got extended about a month. Our drop dead day right now is next Wednesday for the extension of the Farm Bill. April 16th, I think, is the final date that we can tie up money. It's really, for all practical purposes, too late to tie into the bonding bill. We greatly appreciate the effort of all of the members and the governor's office to support that. We're looking to the future, I think, is what we're hoping to know. If we get an extension of the Farm Bill, we've already supplied information, have already provided Washington with the good news that the bonding bill was passed. My boss, Bill Hunt, has already asked for a matching $25 million allocation to Minnesota if the bill does get either extended or we actually do get a Farm Bill. So they know exactly what's going on here, also from the success we have. So for all practical purposes, the money that is available today, really for the next few days, we would never be able to get any additional money obligated. But something's going to happen next Wednesday. I don't know what, but something's going to happen. So we're either going to get that extension with more money, or we're going to have a Farm Bill. So, and again, as you remember from Kevin Lyons and John Jackson's presentation on the proposal on the $25 million, we're talking about a 2 or 3 federal fiscal year perspective here. So there's going to be plenty of efforts. But Mr. Jackson and I talked before, the sooner we can tie up the $25 million and get habitat on the ground and water quality benefits and jobs on the ground, the better. So there's a chance if we get a Farm Bill and we get money, we could have all that $25 million obligated within a 6-month period.
Any other questions? Does anybody else wish to testify or speak?
Thank you.
The next meeting of this committee will be a week from today and will be on Seminary Fab. With that, meeting adjourned.